This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Dr. Matthew Baldwin of Columbia University Irving Medical Center, who joins us now. And he, of course, is a guy who's been dealing with critical care medicine, internal medicine, pulmonary disease medicine. Doc, good morning. Thanks for joining us. How are you?
Good morning, Boomer. Good morning, Gio. I'm doing fine.
All right. So tell us exactly where we are right now with this disease in this city.
I'm going to speak, you know, in the hospital. We have some patients who are critically ill, who we are caring for in the ICU. We have some patients who are hospitalized on the general floors of the hospital. We've been working together regardless of specialty. I'm an ICU doc. There's infectious disease doctors. There's ER doctors. There's nurses to take the sickest patients and get them diagnosed and get them the care they need as quickly as possible.
And Matt, I guess it's all hands on deck for you right now. How are your nurses and how is the hospital handling the caseload right now? And I guess the million-dollar question here is, what do you expect to have happen to your hospital, let's say, between now and 5 to 6 weeks from now?
Yeah, let me first talk about now. And, you know, we've really come together. We have worked with infectious disease. We've worked with anesthesia. We've come up with protocols with internal medicine to figure out what are the blood tests, what are the x-rays that are needed when a patient with potential COVID pneumonia comes in. We have, you know, stopped all elective surgeries, as every hospital has. We are clearing beds in areas of hospitals in anticipation of more patients coming in. And, you know, taking care of these patients is a real team effort. And I think what's really been, you know, important to see is that everyone is stepping up. It's not just the docs. It's the nurses. It's the respiratory therapists. Even think about the people who have to come in our housekeeping and have to put on masks and go in and clean those rooms day in and day out. Everyone's shown up. Everyone's done their job. And so far, we're taking care of these patients and doing our best.
We're talking to Dr. Matthew Baldwin from Columbia University Irving Medical Center. He's one of these frontline docs that are seeing these patients pretty much every single day. When do you think COVID arrived in New York City and basically in this country?
Yeah, so it's publicly known that we took care of one of the first patients diagnosed with COVID in New York, and it was reported in the Post that patient is getting better. He was in our ICU. And if you follow the news reports from that case and you read those reports, you'll also know that patient didn't have any known contact with people in affected countries. So my guess would be that COVID showed up in New York sometime in the middle of February.
So what does that mean for where we are right now in the spread of this disease? So if it was here around the middle of February and we know where we are now, when we project forward to where we're going, what's your best educated opinion on that?
You know, talking with doctors in China, talking with doctors in Italy, we know that if we are strict with social distancing, if we practice hand washing, that we can flatten the curve. I think that's been the slogan that's come out this week. That's so important. And so I think things could potentially become much worse. And as everyone has heard, there's a possibility for a shortage of hospital beds. But I also think that if we all do our part, we can flatten this curve and we can get through this. To the best of my knowledge, right now, we think that 2 to 3 weeks from now, we will be busier than we are.
How about in terms of your patient population now? What are you seeing in terms of ages, the sex, whether or not it's an underlying condition that makes it worse? So what does that look like in your hospital as we speak?
Sure. In terms of age, I think we are starting to see with the very few patients that we have what was seen in France and Italy, and that is that certainly more people who are older and who have pre-existing conditions like diabetes or heart disease or emphysema are getting this. But there's also a substantial number of people who are less than the age of 60 without any health conditions coming in as well. My guess is that if you are younger and you don't have any medical conditions, you are much less likely to develop severe disease. However, I think more of those people are likely infected, which is why we're seeing so many of them come into hospital. In terms of cases by sex, we don't see right now much of a difference between men and women being affected by this.
There's so much. We talked to Dr. Matthew Baldwin of Columbia, and he is on the front line of this every single day. With the underlying conditions, I mean, I think we're assuming that anybody who is of a certain age, over 65, or has a heart disease or any sort of pulmonary disease that is underlying is at risk. But what are the highest risk people? For example, I'm a 37-year-old with asthma. I always need to pay attention to anything that comes along my way. My asthma is under control, but I pay attention to these things. Who are those at the highest risk? What are the underlying conditions that are the highest risk?
Okay, the highest risk patients would be 65 and over, those who have emphysema, diabetes, heart disease, or have some type of medical condition where their immune system is just not healthy, what we call immunocompromised. That's the definition of a high-risk patient.
So this particular COVID-19 turns into what you refer to as viral pneumonia. And the viral pneumonia basically attacks and tears apart the lungs. And, you know, being a cystic fibrosis patient, I know all about these different viruses and how they affect the lungs. Have we had an understanding as to why some people seem to deal with it a little bit better that are relatively healthy and some people don't?
We do not. And that is an area of active research and investigation. Everybody's immune system is probably a little bit different, and there are a lot of things about the immune system we don't understand yet. But here at Columbia University, we've partnered with a rather famous infectious disease doctor here named Dr. David Ho, and we are in the process of collecting blood samples from patients who have recovered from this disease, and we are looking to identify antibodies in these patients who have recovered from COVID-19 to see whether we can find effective antibody therapy for the prevention and treatment of COVID-19 in the future.
Well, we're talking to Dr. Matthew Baldwin from Columbia University Irving Medical Center about COVID-19. And, Doc, we work with three other guys that are also have microphones in front of their mouths. And I asked if they would like to ask a question to you directly. So you guys ready, Al?
We are.
We
this
are.
Is Eddie.
All right. So let's start with you, Eddie. And Eddie, this is Eddie Scazzeri. Eddie is an older gentleman. He does have diabetes. And I don't know if he was going to ask you a question in regards to that, but he's been very open about being one of those high risk patients. Go ahead, Eddie.
My question is really not concerning the diabetes at all. It's if you are tested, will the current tests show if you have been exposed and have come through it?
No. The current test tests for the presence of the virus's RNA. In other words, the presence of the virus's genes in the back of your nose. To figure out whether you've come through it already, that would be an antibody test. And and we are studying patients who have come through it, but we're not checking for their antibodies until about 1 month after they get better.
You know, it's amazing to me, Doc, that you bring that up, because I know people that were very ill in early February that went through all of these tests, these flu tests and everything else that I'm sure some of your initial patients went through before we actually got the COVID-19 test and before we even knew that it existed. Is there a possibility that earlier in February, prior to the first known case here in New York, that people could have had it and gotten through it?
I think that possibility exists. But I think probably the number of people who had COVID-19 at that time were of a very small number, because if there was a lot more people at that time, we'd be seeing a lot more cases now.
So the fear of the healthcare population and those who are healthcare workers and this whole system sort of collapsing, is that something that is alarmist out there in the media and from the leaders to say this is the stuff we have to do to make sure that that doesn't happen? Or do you feel when you go in every day and treat patients that that is an imminent reality?
So I know that leadership here at Columbia University Medical Center has been in contact with the state government, and we've explained that our concern is there is a possibility that we will need additional medical equipment, we will need additional hospital beds, and I think everyone's well aware of that based upon what's been reported. Right now, every day, the docs show up, the nurses show up, the respiratory therapists show up. Right now, we have enough gloves, we have enough masks, and we do our job. And our job is to just get these patients in, get them the best care possible, and get them through this. And right now we're doing that. I hope that leadership and that the government can plan ahead, and we'll do our job.
Guys, can I jump in with my question?
Sure, go ahead, Jerry.
Hey, Doc, it's Jerry. How are you, sir?
Yep. Hi there.
Well, so in these circles, the five of us, I am known as Mr. Positivity around here. So I would like to ask a positive question, if that's okay. Yesterday, the White House came out with what they are hoping could be a medicine that will actually deter this and get rid of it. I know they're in their trials. How long will it take to know, A, and B, if it does so work, how quick would we move through this, and how much of the stress would it take off the hospitals, because now people would think that there is actually a cure?
Yeah, so right now we don't know whether any antiviral or anti-inflammatory, or what we call immunomodulatory drug, works for COVID-19. But you're right. There is a drug called remdesivir that was developed originally to try to treat Ebola that we think might work on this. But we don't have proof yet. We here at Columbia are partnering biotech and pharmaceutical companies to become a part of these trials of antiviral and special immunomodulatory anti-inflammatory therapy. When will we know is difficult to say. There's trials of these drugs on much larger scale that are already ongoing in China. Certainly, the sooner the better, and there's active work here to try to develop antibody therapy as well as a vaccine, so that over the much longer term, hopefully we can protect our population.
And last one for me is, if you get it and you move through it, can you get it again?
We need to study that more. But based upon, infections with other viruses, we think that most people, once they get it, have some amount of immunity to be protected from it again. We'll just have to research that more and see how that pans out.
We're talking to Dr. Matthew Baldwin from the Columbia University Irving Medical Center. He's on the front lines fighting COVID-19 as we speak. And I know, Al Dukes, you probably have a question as well.
Yeah, my whole thing, I feel like, the news makes it seem like everybody has it, and when you get it, it's a death sentence. And yet, when you look around, I don't know if anybody really knows anybody who has it. There's no end game here as to when we can start having normal lives again. And I think the people that are doing the right thing now, at some point, like Memorial Day weekend, they're going to say, enough. My business, I'm out of work. My business is being shut down. Are we going to be any clearer by Memorial Day as to what is going on?
Ooh, I don't have a crystal ball, and I don't think anyone else does either. But, you know, news came out yesterday that there's, forgive me because I'm taking care of patients every day, that the number of cases in China, and especially in the Wuhan province, there's barely any, and maybe even zero. And so they showed the world something. They shut it down for a certain amount of time, and they flatten the curve. And then once you flatten the curve, hopefully the curve then starts to go down. And so I think we have to do this. Otherwise, I think, you know, a large proportion of the population will get infected. And even if only, you know, less than 1% die, that will be tens or hundreds of thousands of people who will die from this. I wish I had a better answer for you, but we just don't right now.
What are the most common symptoms that you're seeing in the patients that you are treating?
You have to remember that I'm an ICU doctor, so I'm seeing really only the worst 5% of all cases. And what we're seeing is these patients have often had symptoms for about a week when they're coming into the ICU, that they've already been on a little bit of oxygen, that they have a high fever, and they get to a point where their lungs just can't pull oxygen out of the air well enough on their own, and they're so tired out that we have to hook them up to a ventilator. Where we can push high concentrated and high pressure oxygen into their lungs to keep them alive and going.
So you also can use an ECMO, device. Explain what an ECMO device is.
So an ECMO device is essentially something similar to an artificial lung, where we put a catheter into a patient, similar to a catheter that's used for dialysis. And we pump blood out of the body and oxygenate it and put oxygen into it and pump it back in. We anticipate that there will be patients who might need ECMO for very severe COVID disease. We don't know how many that will be. We think it'll be a very small fraction. And we're going to do our best to offer that to patients as much as we can here at Columbia. But we have to remember this is a new technology that's really only been developed and put into use in the last 10 years, and it's still very limited.
You know, this may be above your pay grade, Dr. Matthew Baldwin, although I don't think anything's above your pay grade given what you're doing and what you're dealing with right now. But if, in fact, there is a shortage of these ventilators and ECMO machines and things of that nature, and all of a sudden you get overrun with patients, what is the ethical and moral situations that you may find yourself in, and what is the hospital or hospital systems, I should say, here in New York State prepared to do in that regard?
Well, I think that issue has been brought up by leadership here. Both by people with expertise in ethics and in law, and they've been in contact with the state government. Because I think to try to put that on any one doc is difficult. I think, though, that issue has been raised and people are starting to think about it. And that's really what I've seen here more than anything else, is people are working tirelessly. Whether they are in administration, whether they are in law, medicine, whether they're a doc, a nurse, or even a housekeeper, to do whatever they can to plan ahead and then care for those who are sick here and now every day.
I just one other thing I want to ask you. I don't know if you know the answer to this. I was reading an article yesterday, and very well thought out article, and it was written by somebody who has also lived the life that you have lived. You've seen this, and I don't even know if you were consulted on any of this stuff, but they were talking about how back in 2015, when they were looking at the stockpiles of ventilators and things of that nature, they realized that it was low and they could have actually done something about it, but nothing was done about it. And now here we sit with the potential mass caseload coming your way and having a shortage of ventilators. How concerned are you moving forward with that shortage? And in your eyes, what should be done as we move forward through this in that regard?
Well, I think this is where we need probably government and we need industry to step in. We talked about, World War II factories were making products. And stopped doing what they were doing just to help make what was needed for the war. Will that be needed here in the United States? Perhaps on a very small level. I think people in industry and in government need to get creative, and we need to prepare. But for the moment, right now, we've stopped all elective surgeries. We have cleared out areas of the hospital in anticipation of these patients. We've got a good count on our ventilators. We thought about ventilators that are used in the OR that we could potentially use. And simply we're going to go day by day and do our best.
A couple more for Dr. Matthew Baldwin of Columbia University Irving Medical Center on Boomer and Geo on the Fan. What is the most important thing from your perspective that everybody who's listening needs to do?
Yeah, great question. I think we need to kind of put aside our differences, and we need to realize that if we're gonna beat this thing, we're gonna do it together. That sounds ironic because everyone's being asked to stay away from each other. But now's the time that we need to actually come together. And so, what does that mean? I think that means that we should, you know, listen to our leaders and really practice this social distancing. It's even if you say to yourself, I'm not going to get sick, I'm young, I'm healthy. Well, you might be right, but you might also end up being the person who transmits the virus along to other people. And so we all have to do our part to flatten this curve and to stop the transmission so that everything that we just talked about for the last 10 minutes about being concerned about, you know, having a shortage of hospital beds doesn't ever happen. I think, you know, older adults who are, you know, really being asked to stay at home and not go out, those who are most susceptible of dying of this infection, you know, maybe it's time to step up in our communities on an individual basis and leave a meal, you know, at that person's door, help them out. I think we all got to figure out how to care for one another. I've been a New Yorker for my whole life, and what I know is that sometimes the worst situations in this area bring out the best in people. We saw it in the aftermath of September 11th, and I think we're going to start seeing it now.
Yeah, I hope you're right, Doc, and you certainly exemplify that. Can you compare this particular COVID-19 virus to the H1N1 in 2009, to SARS back in 2002, and I think MERS was right in between that, somewhere around 2004, 2005. Those three, and Ebola, of course, those four, I should say, compared to COVID, and how contagious this is and how dangerous this is compared to those.
Okay. Ebola is a much more deadly virus that was primarily just in Africa. So let's put that one aside. MERS and SARS really never got out to the United States. Let's put those aside. I think you bring up a good point with the H1N1, what we called swine flu back in 2009. I remember that year working in the ICU, and there was a tremendous number of patients, and there was a strain on the system. In tens of thousands of people in America died, but they died over the course of a year, not over the course of a month. And so we, at least here at Columbia, and I'm sure at all the other major medical centers, this isn't our first rodeo. And we've worked hard. We've dealt with many sick patients with breathing problems on ventilators in the past. We'll use that experience of having worked together to try to see ourselves through this now. I think certainly we refined how to work as a team with very severe cases of swine flu, and I think we'll use that experience to treat our very severe cases of COVID.
I just have one more for you because we know that you need to go. And you know, those who think that they have this and those that are showing up to the emergency room, I mean, that could be a problem too and put a strain on the system. What do you recommend to somebody who believes that they are coming down with this and need more information and not to just run to an emergency room or a hospital to make things worse for everybody?
Right. I think that's a good point because if you happen to have this, you don't want to spread it to other people. So what we're doing with Columbia, with Cornell, with New York Presbyterian is we're trying to do as many televisits as possible. So call your doctor. We are setting up video conference visits, and we have a guideline that we've created and that we continue to update. I'm sure other medical centers are doing the same, where we will guide patients through whether to stay at home, to self-quarantine, and then to call us back if certain symptoms develop. And we have an algorithm that we've created and we look at every day to determine whether still appropriate as to who we should ultimately call in to get tested. The vast majority of people, especially those without health conditions who don't have symptoms or just have very mild symptoms, really should just isolate at home.
So, and that's the last point I want to make with you too, Doc, is the fact that, you know, there are some people who have been exposed to COVID-19 patients, and a lot of companies, CBS, in fact, Entercom, the one that we work for, has decided to clean out the buildings for non-essential in-person personnel. That's why Gio and I can do our show from home. Let's say you're in that 14-day quarantine and you show no signs and you come out of it. That doesn't mean start running the streets. That means still stay inside and still stay away from people because even though you may not have it or may not show any signs of it, there's still the stay-at-home kind of feel that we all need to practice in order to flatten out this curve.
Yeah. I think it's important, you know, that we just practice the social distancing. I think as, what we're being told, and I'm obeying the recommendations of the governor, as I'm sure other people, is, you know, we still need to go out and we still need to go get our food, and we still need to do a certain amount of daily business just to keep our lives going. But yes, to continue to minimize that. Once you are better, potentially from this, it doesn't mean you should go out. And also, if you never got tested, you might have just had the regular cold and not have had this. And so you can't assume that you had this if you just got the sniffles. So you might be at risk for getting sick from it again. Because remember, the vast majority of people who are young and have very little symptoms aren't going to get an official test for this right now.
Yeah, that was the first time I stepped on you, and I lied because, you know, we in the assistants, when we start dealing with doctors like you, we ask a million questions because we're never totally satisfied. It was something always pops up into our mind and things of that nature. You know, for patients out there that, are doing the telemedicine and everything else, What is the point where you would recommend that person to get to the hospital if you were talking to them over the phone and they were giving you the symptoms and doing some sort of video conferencing with them? What does it take for somebody to actually go to the hospital?
Right now, our current guidelines are people who are having high fevers, cough, and in particular, shortness of breath.
Okay. All right. Well, sounds good, Doc. I appreciate it. I don't know, Gio, if you have any more questions?
No, just if there's anything that we missed, anything we didn't ask you about that's very, very important that you have been seeing that people need to know. That would be the only last question that I would have for you.
I think the messaging by the governor and by the state and by the press, which is practice social distancing, is real. I think this is a time when we need to come together, and I think if we look out for one another by practicing social distancing, and by finding creative ways to prevent this infection, but make sure older adults are still looked on after, I think we'll be all the better for it.
Doc, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it and everything you're doing. We thank you so much, you and your colleagues, to keep it up because we all need you. Thanks again.
Thank you, Boomer, Gio, Al.
All righty. See you, Matt.
All right. That's Dr. Matthew Baldwin, Columbia University Irving Medical Center. I mean, he's going to hang up the phone here with us and then go treat some COVID-19 patients in the ICU. So just an amazing man doing some great work right now when we need him and his colleagues the most.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.